Well, as you see, the holiday club this week is entitled The Great Escape. And I'm afraid when I hear those words, I think not of Egypt, but of the 1963 classic, which Toby mentioned earlier. I wonder if you ever saw it. For me, The Great Escape makes up precisely one third of my early childhood Christmas memories. The first third of every Christmas day was Santa. And the good thing about Santa was you always knew what you'd get in our household, always a tangerine and a sugared mouse. He was the most reliable of all present givers. Then the second third of the day was taken up with a kind of monster lunch where my dad had fallen asleep at the dinner table by about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And then the third, the final third of the day, The Great Escape. All of us in front of the box, and it was played every single year by the BBC, kind of run out of other films, let's play The Great Escape. And to see Steve McQueen do it all over again every single year, and the other 76 who escaped from Hut 104 and Nazi Camp Stalag 3, it made Christmas Day for us. Mind you, when you think about it, the escape stories in the Bible are so much more remarkable even than Steve McQueen, were that possible. In that, I don't know if you knew this, but in The Great Escape, only three of them actually escaped in the end. 77 got out, 76 got out, the 77th was spotted, and of those, 74 were rounded up, of whom actually 50 were executed, and three of them got out. It was terrible, terrible odds. They were trying to get 250 out, and managed three. When God rescued Egypt across the Red Sea, he got 600,000 out and not a single casualty on the way. And that is what you really call a great escape. Now this morning we're looking actually at another passage in the Bible, because the Bible is full of these occasions when God rescues people. We're looking at another one also involving water. And I want us to look at it because it has great relevance for us today, even if we didn't know that up until this point, and I'm glad you're here to hear it. Verse 35, we're told that it was evening time, and Jesus said to the disciples, "Come on, let's go across to the other side of the lake." And so they get in a boat and begin to cross the Sea of Galilee. For us, it would be like getting in a boat and going across to Diamond Harbour. A bit of a trip, but hopefully no problem. Except on this day, there was a problem, a massive problem, because such a huge storm blew up. We're told in verse 37, it is a furious squall. Such a huge storm blew up that they are in danger of drowning, and they fear for their very lives. It reminds me of a time that I was rung up as a friend some years ago who owned a boat, and he was very keen to go out for a sail. He asked me two questions. Question one, did I want to go for a sail? Question two, was I able to sail? And not wanting to underplay the experience I'd gained between the ages of 4 and 7 on family holidays, I answered a bold yes to both questions. What did he mean, could I sail? And so we set off. I knew it was bad when the cornflakes made a second appearance that morning and we hadn't even left the harbour. And there I was slithering around like a jellyfish. You're actually going between the River Orwell and up to Lowestoft. It was a terribly, terribly rough day. We couldn't even see the shore, and we were only 400 or 500 metres from it, lurching up and down. And my friend said, "Are you all right?" And I couldn't do anything. And he kindly came and clipped me on so we didn't have man overboard. Now, I can sympathise with these disciples. They're totally helpless. Waves were crashing over, and the boat was nearly swamped. It is a situation that was clearly beyond them, and they are in great danger. They are staring death in the face. Now, when you think about it, terrifying as it was for them, our situation is not as different to them as it might seem at first. I know that here we are on a beautiful day, sitting in a school hall, and it's all fine. But when you think about it, we are actually, each one of us, staring death in the face ourselves. For long periods of time, we go without thinking about it. And I suppose that's where it's different to being on a boat where you think you're about to drown. And death in our culture has been swept away. It is not a visible entity like it once was. For us, you just see a sign that's been put up down the road, a house has gone for sale. And we kind of forget that that represents that someone has moved into a hospice. And very soon they will quietly slip away. But every so often, it does rear its head. And we are reminded that we are all staring death in the face. Maybe you get a phone call from the doctor with some bad news. Or one of your parents is diagnosed with something. Or there is bad news about a grandparent. Every so often, death intrudes itself into our lives, and we are reminded that we too are staring it in the face. And the reason that is frightening is because the day we die is the day that we meet the living God. If only death was the end, it wouldn't be so bad. What makes it bad is that we meet the person who made us, who created us, and who loves us when we die. And even though, because he loves us, he is angry at the way that we have treated him. If you're like me, you have spent much of your life blocking him out. And we take the good things that he gives us, the family, the friends, the food, and all the things that we enjoy, we take those things, but we don't give him the time of day. Now just imagine if someone treated you in the same kind of way. Maybe you don't have to imagine. Maybe that's what happens at home. That someone you've created, let's say one of your children, comes in one day and you're just sitting at the table there, and they come in, open the fridge door, gobble, 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 and they just kind of walk past you, and you say something to them, and they grunt at you back, and then they trough through a few other things, and then they go up to their room and turn on the music, volume 10, and you're left wondering, oh, hello, do we have a relationship, or are you just using my house type of thing? Now, just suppose it got worse. Suppose, you know, they get absolutely fed up of the cramping restrictions that boring adults put on them, and they decide to leave home for a while. And then after 3 or 4 days, they wander back in, and they brought a stream of their lovely friends with them who were just behind them. And as they walk in this time, they toss back on the table the credit card, which they borrowed from your wallet without asking, and they gobble through what you've stocked up the fridge with again, and they go up to their room, and their friends tramp through the house with them. Very soon, the only question would be, how long would you put up with it for? And with God, the only question is, how long will he put up with us for? For we have been doing the same thing in his world, gobbling up the good things that he gives us, but ignoring him at the same time. It is offensive to him. No wonder he is angry with us. And we find this so hard to grasp, because naturally, I think that I'm a good person. And if you ask your friends, they will probably say of you that they love you and they think you are a good person. But that's a bit like asking the friends of that teenager, oh, what do you think about Jack? Oh, he's brilliant. He always lets us go to his house and trash it. And he has great parties. He's such a great guy. Yeah, but if you ask the parents, you might actually get a bit of a different view. And so it is with God. If you ask God what we're like, he might give us a different view. And actually, a more accurate view, even than what our friends say, and certainly than what we say about ourselves. This is the problem, that we have put ourselves against God by ignoring him and trying to push him away. And we find now that not only are we against him, but he is against us. And the question is, when we meet God, if I am pretending to be God and he is God, who will win? Because there is only room for one of us. And you can't beat God at his own game. He is very good at it. That is why he is still God. So can I ask you this morning, have you realized that you are in danger? Did you know that you're in danger? Maybe you didn't, and this is the first time you've heard about it. But I tell you what, it's better to know it and then see if there's a solution than not to know it at all. And the wonderful news of the Bible is that God has seen the danger ahead of time and taken action so that we might be made safe. And that's really the experience that the disciples had this day back in the boat. God saw the danger they were in and took action that they might be safe. Not only was a rescue needed, a rescue was provided for them. You see that in verse 38. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. And the disciples, it's actually a very interesting reaction. They go and wake him. It's interesting because most of the disciples are fishermen. They know a thing or two about being on a boat. They're the kings of the sea. And so they go to the one person in the boat who's a carpenter. Odd. But they've seen Jesus do other things. And although they don't know fully who he is, they do have a sneaking suspicion that he may be able to help where they cannot help themselves. And when you can't help yourself, it's amazing what you'll do to find a way out. And so they go to Jesus and they say this wonderful question, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" Does he care? Does God care for us? You ever ask the question? You know, you see the situation I'm in, God. See what's happened to me over the last 2 years? Or you see what's happened more recently? Do you care? We'll just have a look to see if Jesus cares for them. Verse 39. He got up, rebuked the wind and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." And the wind died down and it was completely calm. They knew that there is more to Jesus than meets the eye, and their confidence is well placed. Can you imagine someone standing on a boat and talking to the wind and the waves, "Quiet, be still." And the whole thing goes as quiet, as flat as a mill pond. You have to be pretty confident to know what you're doing before you try that one in public. But Jesus does know what he's doing. For here is the creator of the world, the one who made the sea in the first place, standing there, able to speak to the sea. And it does exactly what he commanded. The wind died down and it was completely calm. The verse I love is actually verse 36. There were also other boats there with him. Can you imagine what it would have been like to be on one of those other boats? I mean, at least the disciples saw what was happening. But you're on one of those other boats, just about to die, and suddenly, the whole thing's completely calm with no explanation. Even more bizarre for them, at least the disciples knew how this had happened, even if they didn't totally get who was in the boat. Jesus had performed this amazing miracle. He had made the sea go as flat as a mill pond. And who else in the history of the earth would even think of trying to do such a thing? Now, Jesus then asked them two questions in verse 40. He turns to his disciples. "Why are you so afraid?" It's kind of an odd question. I mean, of course we know why they were afraid, but there are times when he might say to us the same thing. "Why are you so afraid?" And we say, "Well, it's obvious why I'm afraid. I mean, here is a situation I can't handle. This is happening, or this is happening, or this is happening." Or more to the point, when we are faced with death, when we are looking death in the eye, we are afraid. And rightly so. And then he asks the critical question, "Do you still have no faith?" That is, he is encouraging them to entrust themselves to him, to Jesus. Because once you know someone more powerful than death, you don't need to be afraid of it. Once your worst problem is taken care of, it brings a marvelous freedom. Don't you think it would be a great thing to live your life knowing that the problem of death had been taken care of? Wouldn't that be a good thing? Wouldn't that help you to face the future with confidence? Because here is the one person who is able to do that. And so Jesus says, "Do you still have no faith? Trust me," he says. Because after all, here is the person who not only calmed a storm, here is the person who was raised from the dead, who raised himself from the dead, so that those who trust in him might have the confidence that they would one day live forever. Now, the disciples, they seem to have just absolutely had their minds blown. Verse 41, we read that they were terrified and they asked each other, "Who is this? Even the wind and the waves obey him." Jesus has just exploded their categories. Who is this, they ask, of the man standing next to them? And the answer is, here is God himself. The God who made the sea is standing with them in the boat and is able to control the sea. The king of the whole earth is within touching distance. Kings and queens now, at least in Western nations, are they can be great people and people that we look up to, certainly the case with our own queen. But we know, I say it with a heavy heart as an Englishman, we know that they don't have any power. It's all frills. It's what they wear. But there's no actual sort of control. I mean, there was a time when they used to rule the world, and now they don't have even any power in their own country. But Jesus shows himself here to be a proper king, a king who is powerful enough to rescue his own people, for he saves his disciples from death. And not only powerful, to be powerful and evil is the worst of all combinations, but Jesus is the best of all combinations. He is the most powerful and the most kind. And when you've got someone like that who is batting on your side, you are in a mighty strong position. Now they ask the question, don't you care if we drown? And we might ask the same, don't you care, God? Don't you care? In the day of death, particularly, don't you care? And Jesus says, I do care. And to show you that I care, I want to solve your greatest problem. And he does that at the end of his life. The rest of his life is teaching leading up until that point. But at the end of that life, he chooses to die himself, that the sins, the rebellion of those of us who have not lived for God, i.e. the rest of us, are tipped onto him. It's as if they go into a funnel and land on the head of one man, Jesus, as he dies. So that as he dies, he takes the punishment of death that otherwise would come to us. He takes it on himself that we might be given the gift of life. He's given the exit from God's presence that we might be given the entry into God's presence forevermore. We need to be rescued from our sins, and God has provided just such a rescue. You may remember from the celebrations earlier in the year that this is the centenary of the sinking of the Titanic. And I've got in my hand here a little copy of a telegram which was sent from one of the survivors, sent from New York back to their home in Europe. On it is just a single word, and the word is saved. Saved. In other words, the ship has sunk, so many have died, but I have been saved. And when it comes to a choice between life or death, that's the only thing you want to be able to say. To be able to say, I have been saved from death, is a wonderful, wonderful thing. And also brings great happiness to many other people that know you, particularly if they're Christians who have longed for you to be that person who would trust Jesus. And so a choice lies before us. Jesus says, do you still have no faith? He encourages us to entrust ourselves to him, to put our trust in him. For the person who puts his trust in him will be the person whose sins are forgiven forever. And I want to ask you this morning, would you be someone who would say, yes, yes, I want to be saved. I want to be rescued from death. And I want to be able to live for God forever, with God forever. Well, the question is, will you take Jesus up on the offer? We had a little snapshot earlier of a man who was there at the time during the Great Escape, Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, who was so stubborn, he just would not do it. Would not do it. And still at the end of his life, even when death was the only option, would not do it. And sad to say, there are some people like that today who are so stubborn, they would rather go to hell with their head held high than go to heaven on bended knee. And that is what pride does to us. It is a terrible thing. But to say to Jesus, yes, I admit that I have done you wrong, that I have blocked out God. to say, thank you for dying for me to take away all my sins, and to say, yes, please, please forgive me. It's a marvelous thing, for God is only too pleased to have us back. And whatever kind of life we've lived up until now, and maybe this is the first time you've ever been in church, maybe it's the first time you've ever really heard anything about Jesus, he longs to have you back, to have you back as a child of his, if only you'll say yes to him. In a group this size, I would imagine there'd be at least three groups of people. There'll be those of us who have said to Jesus at some point in the past, yes, thank you, I want to say yes, please forgive me. And I hope today that this passage is as good for you now as it may have been in the past. I particularly want to encourage you not only to trust God for your salvation, but to trust him in every part of life. I'm reminded of John Chapman, who you may have heard speak over here. He certainly came over a number of times, who told me once, and I've heard him speak on this passage many, many times. He told me once, he said, it's funny, Costa, how it's easier to preach this passage to others than it is to apply it to yourself. He said once the doctor rang him a few years ago and said, is that you, Chapo? He said, it is. He said, I've got your results back. Can you come and see me? Chapo said, is everything okay? The fellow said, you have got no time to waste. Get in the car and come and see me. As he got in the car, he said, I was absolutely terrified. I didn't know if I would even make it. And then he said, I remember this passage. Don't you care? Don't you care for us, Jesus? And he does care for us in all the circumstances of life. So I want to encourage you to apply it to yourself, for every part of life, not only for salvation. That's the first group of people, people who've said yes to Jesus. The second group is those who feel there is more investigating to do. And if this is new to you, or you haven't really applied your mind to it, it may be that is the case. I want to recommend a couple of books that are on the bookstall. There's this one here, they're both free. There's this one here, The Essential Jesus, which is a copy of one of the New Testament accounts of Jesus' life. You can take one, you can read it for yourself. It's only, 60, 70 pages. You'll probably knock it off in a couple of days. And ask yourself the same question the disciples said. Who is this? You could take one of those. Or a question of by the man I've just mentioned, John Chapman. He's written out what it means to be a Christian, what the message of Christianity is. These are absolutely free. It's called A Fresh Start. You can take one from the bookstall. Why don't you do that? And ask questions and ask a Christian friend questions, if you're not sure, if you've got questions. The third group might be those who say, I realise it is time I said yes to the offer that is being made. And I want to give you a chance to do that now. I'm going to say a prayer, and if you want to make it your own, I'll say it slowly, and you can repeat it in your head to God, and he will surely hear you. Let's bow our heads, pray together. Dear God, I admit that I have blocked you out. I admit that I'm a sinner. Thank you for sending Jesus to die for my sins. Please forgive me, and please help me from now on to have Jesus as my Saviour and as my King. Amen. Do look up there. I want to say thank you for listening. And I want to say if you felt able to pray that kind of a prayer for the first time today, then today is a wonderful day for you, because you come here at odds with God and you leave here being friends with God. And that's the best change that can ever happen in a person's life. I'd love to help you more. Do come and see me afterwards and I can point you in the right direction if that's helpful.